This is one of our favorite outdoor explorers and first aired in January of 2015.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. I've done some solo backpacking, and sometimes I've loved it, and sometimes I've been lonely and scared. Having someone else along is a safety factor and usually makes a trip more fun. But I remember some of my solo trips the best, for a lot of reasons. There's something about that private test, completely absent from the social part of life, when you come into close contact with yourself. And that's our topic on this week's show. We're talking with outdoor folk who, either by choice or necessity, have gone it alone on outdoor adventures and challenges. My first guest today is Lonnie Dupree, who summited Mount McKinley over the weekend, or Denali as most Alaskans know it. He was all by himself, the first person to succeed in a solo ascent in the month of January. Denali in the winter is one of the most hostile spots on earth, but this was Dupree's fourth time attempting it on his own, and we were delighted to hear he'd made it to the top. We recorded our interview with Lonnie in December, right before he headed to Talkeetna to begin what we now know is a successful winter summit attempt all on his own. So this is not the first time you've attempted this, right, Lonnie?
This will be my fourth time. I climbed it successfully in the summer in 2009, but this is my this will be my fourth winter attempt.
And you're going it alone?
I'm going it alone. Yeah, I'll be a solo. I'll start in December 15th, weather permitting, and hopefully get up sometime mid January if all goes good.
Yeah. Well, take your radio so you can listen to our show on the air while you're up there. I'm just curious as to the attractions and of doing like this hard of a climb, this long of a climb all by yourself. I mean, is it getting kind of lonely up there?
No, actually, in terms of expeditions, this is a relatively short trip for me. Most of my expeditions are anywhere from, anywhere from 2 to 6, 7, 8 months long. So actually looking at Denali, when you're at Denali being anywhere from 30 to 45 days, it's relatively a short expedition for me. So I can mentally get my head around that, and then I can also see my objective, which is the summit from base camp. So it helps me just put it all in perspective versus like going to the North Pole where it's your objective is 600 miles away, and you've got miles and miles of sea ice you're trying to get around. And so it's much better. It's much easier to just get your head around. And I don't get too lonely up there. I mean, I have you guys to listen to on my transistor radio, for one. I've done it now three other times, so it's... It'll be good. It's just fine for me. I don't mind it at all. The only rough part is being up there over the holidays, but I picked that time because it gives me more of a chance to get up there in the month of January, which is my objective. And I feel by leaving slightly earlier in December, it gives me a little better weather window.
Huh. So do you prefer traveling and doing expeditions by yourself rather than with companions?
No, I'd much rather travel with somebody else. But with Denali, because of the difficulty in the cold weather, and also
nobody else wants to do it, right?
I'm in winter. I just as soon do it on my own because then I don't have to worry about my my teammate or anything like that. I can just concentrate on climbing, and it's really hard to find somebody that with that combined skill of both climbing and extreme cold weather.
Right. Or somebody who wants to do it, right? Because there's this aspect of when you're with somebody else, you often maybe don't want to impose suffering on that person that you might be willing to impose upon yourself, right?
Yeah, and I don't. For me, it used to be suffering in the early days. Now I don't like getting cold, so I'm pretty well prepared. I eat well. I eat the proper food. I dress properly, and a lot of that training is coming good for because of my climbs on other climbs, and also a lot of my North Pole trips. So my North Pole trips, which are quite cold. You know, when I leave Ellesmere Island on a North Pole trip, it's 58 below zero. And it doesn't warm up at all. It pretty much stays below zero the whole trip. And actually, last time I was there, the cold warmed up to 25 below zero. That just keeps me, I don't mind it at all. I'm quite, I got good clothing, really good food, so it keeps me going.
Yeah, those super cold North Pole expeditions are just crazy. I mean, the cold you encounter on those is sort of out of bounds of anything else you do, right? And so you're dealing with frozen everything all the time.
Both when I circumnavigated Greenland too, we had minus 58, and we traveled through lots of polar darkness as well as we start out in really low light conditions on the North Pole trip, and then in years ago in 91 I did the famed Northwest Passage expedition, which went from Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, the Church of Manitoba, and we went through 64 days of polar night, and we had steady temperatures of minus 35 or so.
Wow. So in doing this, I mean, obviously you've done such extraordinary expeditions before, and I'm curious why Denali continues to present a challenge to you or something you want to do. You've been up it before, you've done these other incredible expeditions. What's the attraction for doing it this winter?
Well, it's personal for me. I really like the lighting up there in January. It's really beautiful up there. It's quite amazing. Very few people get a chance to see that. And if I can relay some of that information back to folks back home, that's kind of fun. And then it gives me a chance to really fine-tune my plan and go through the plan and execute my plan. And that, for me, is rewarding, especially on a trip like that, because it really tests everything. It tests your mental strength. It tests your equipment. It tests your clothing, your food. And this is good for me, whether I make it or not. It's what I've been doing my whole life, and just trying to fine tune everything that so it works smoothly. Because I'm like, you know what, people hate being cold. And even though I'm not an Inuit person, I don't like being cold either. So I take really great care and comfort, even though I may be taking a little more equipment than you typically would for climb other times of the year.
It's kind of amazing. So, and actually, it's really amazing. But it seems like one of your challenges of climbing, like you're going right into the shortest days of the year. It's going to be dark, and there's not that many hours when you can actually make progress. I mean, do you climb in the dark, or do you? How do you handle that?
Well, in the very beginning, you have 5 hours of usable light. It's not sunny all the time. It's just usable light, and then the rest of the time you got to use your headlamp. So in the first days, 5 hours of steady progress pulling 170-pound sled, you know, on the lower part of the Kilhilton, the glacier, you're tired after 5 hours anyway. And so then you, whenever you're setting up camp or building a snow shelter, you can do that with a headlamp. And then once you get in the snow shelter, you have your headlamp. So any usable light is when I'm actually traveling. And then when it's starting to get dark, I stop traveling and use my headlamp. Now, as you get higher up the mountain, of course, you have more hours of light because you're higher up, right, higher above the horizon, so you get more light. And then later in the season, as we're approaching into January, you know, it's not a lot, but by the end of January, up at 17,000 feet, for instance, I got about 7.25 to 7.5 hours of usable light.
Interesting. Never thought about that elevation factor. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, and really 7 hours of hard climbing in those cold conditions is tiring. So,
right. So
it's okay to, camp then and get a good night's sleep.
Yeah.
And you got to acclimate anyways to altitude. So.
So, I mean, just thinking about this solo aspect of it, when you've only got 5 hours of light to travel, that's 19 hours when you are in camp in the dark. Do you get lonely, or how do you psychologically keep yourself you know, not, well, not from going stir crazy.
Yeah, the first 2 hours, of course, is building your snow shelter or preparing camp, and then you got to spend another hour or so melting water, and another hour or so cooking dinner, and then another hour getting your stuff ready for bed, and then pretty soon all of the day's already shot. So it's also there's also other things you can do. There's always little things to do, like write in your journal, prepare for an update, to update our website, oneworldendeavors.com, if people want to follow us. And then and there's always seems to be something to do. And if I run out of things to do, then I can always turn some music on the iPod and just chill out.
Cool. Well, it sounds, I mean, you're the challenge of survival is enough that it takes up most of your time and most of your mental effort, it sounds like.
It really does. It really does. And, I mean, during the day when I'm traveling, if I'm on a flat section of glacier and I'm not overly worried about crevices, then I'll throw on my iPod and listen to some, you know, good old rock and roll, or I might even put some Dylan in or something like that. And if I get into more technical aspect of the climb where maybe it's steeper or more dotted with crevice and I need to pay attention, I might throw some classical music on.
What are the factors that you are most aware of in terms of hazards or things that could go wrong or things you have to be ready for, or even things that scare you when you're climbing Denali by yourself?
Well, the biggest fear for me is wind, being caught in the wind, because the wind, when wind whistles through mountains, it's not a steady wind. It's buffeted type winds that, you know, go from 30 to 60 miles an hour in a hurry, and they can knock you off balance. And not climbing solo without rope, of course, is very dangerous if you slip. So that's one of my biggest concerns. My next concern probably is, I would say, is crevices. But I've designed the skis I'm taking this year are 4 inches wide, 8 feet long, yellow birch that I made and steam bent from my home in northeastern Minnesota. So they'll be coming along with me, and they'll help me bridge crevices that I might otherwise miss, and support me over those bridges. So that
would
help.
Mean because
be
the skis are so
14 foot long spruce pole.
So
that would just kind of drag alongside me and attach to the hip belt.
So the long skis are long, big surface area skis that you've custom made, just because that will spread your weight over more snow and reduce the chance of falling through into a crevice.
That's correct. And they're longer too. Yes.
Wow. So you're not an aluminum ladder person who brings a ladder along?
Well, I have in the past, but they're too heavy and it's bulky, and it just doesn't. I don't think it's needed. I think you're better off having longer skis and then using a wood pole in place of the ladder. And if you go down the crevice with the skis on and the wood pole, the nice thing about the wood pole, which is a whole lot lighter than the ladder, you can still persic up that pole using persics.
Wow.
Versus, let's say, an aluminum pole or something like that.
Well, this is an amazing expedition, Lonnie, and we're recording you from Kentucky by phone before you go up. You're going to be heading up there in a little while, and then we're going to be broadcasting this interview when you will hopefully be nearing the end point of your adventure, and we just wish you all the luck in the world.
Yeah, thanks so much, Charles. I really appreciate this.
All right, thanks. That's Lonnie Dupree, who is planning this solo assault on Mount McKinley, which is and has done so many extraordinary adventures around the world, and really appreciate him being with us. Lonnie Dupree is one familiar face on Talkeetna's winter mountaineering season, but he's not the only one who makes the pilgrimage each year. There's another mountaineer who comes all the way from Japan. He's nicknamed the Japanese Caribou. Our producer, Monica Goki, has the story.
Every winter, the Alaska Range draws a handful of diehards who make an annual pilgrimage to its harsh mountainous environment. One of those people is Masatoshi Kuriaki. He is better known to some as the Japanese Caribou. The Caribou is a mountaineer with a penchant for solo expeditions. Make that solo winter expeditions. He soloed Mount Foraker in the winter of 2007, Denali in 98. The only major Alaska Range summit he's missing is Mount Hunter. And it's not for lack of trying. He's attempted that one 8 times, all in the winter. Last year, he spent 66 days on the mountain before turning back. Right before his 7th attempt on Hunter, the Japanese caribou sat down with our partner station in Talkeetna to talk about what lures him into tackling these burly expeditions every winter. Here's what he told KTNA's Philip Manning.
Winter's nature is more variety, so wide range, because, for example, in summer, almost always midnight sun, except twilight, but almost bright. And instead of winter time, very darkness, but also the climbers have experience to see northern lights, shooting star, and morning glow, and sunset, like so pretty, like a pink one. Yeah, it's unbelievable sight.
As of 2014, the Japanese caribou has spent a total of 772 days alone in the Alaska Range during the winter. And he's not through yet. Why do you do it, he says, is a common question he hears all the time.
Many people asked the climbers, why climb? So I want to say, I just want to enjoy being there. That's it.
This year, Masatoshi is taking a winter off. He's headed to Hawaii with his family, he writes via email, to celebrate the nuptials of some of his Alaska friends. But come 2015, the caribou says he plans to be back on Hunter for the 9th time. In Anchorage, I'm Monica Goki.
This episode of Outdoor Explorer first aired in January of 2015.
The way shadow falls to ground and a dirt road turns to dust. Where your harvest moon gets round and the autumn leaves turn to rust. The way the tide gets low and the birds know to fly south, like the mountaintops gather snow. Big river gets salty at the mouth. There's a peace, a peace I have never known. A peace I have never known. That's a peace. I have never known.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth, and our topic today is going it alone, being alone in the outdoors to do your adventures, without a partner, without family, without sort of all the backup that you might get or the social experience you might get if you have someone with you. And there can be various reasons for it and various levels of doing it. And my next guest is, unlike Lonnie Dupree, who we heard from earlier, who is sort of the extreme example, headed to the North Pole and headed to the top of Mount McKinley, Mike Kramer is an attorney in Fairbanks, a lifelong Alaskan, hunter, fisherman, skier, runner, probably like a lot of our listeners. And Mike spent a lot of time doing his outdoor adventures on his own and having the, for all the reasons that we've been talking about. And thanks for being with us, Mike.
Thank you, Charles. It's a pleasure to be here.
So it sounds like you kind of you kind of grew up as an outdoorsman in Fairbanks, and it sometimes, just for practicality's sake, when you go hunting, or maybe a lot of times, you go by yourself.
That's true, Charles. As you said, I grew up living an outdoor lifestyle here in Fairbanks, and as I progressed and kind of narrowed my range of activities, I find myself doing more and more things by myself, often multi-day adventures, but significantly a number of day trips as well.
Yeah. So, and sometimes that's just because you can't find anybody to go with you, but do you also find an attractiveness of just being out there by yourself and sort of getting out of town and nobody else to bug you?
There is. That's entirely accurate. Oftentimes, as you said, no one else is on your schedule or your enthusiasm level for a particular activity, but there's a certain sense of satisfaction you get when you do it on your own and craft your own adventure the way you want it and set your own timetable and plan your own menu and be responsible for yourself out there. I take a lot of satisfaction in that, making sure that I'm well prepared, that I have everything I need for anything I might encounter, and that I don't have someone to that can back me up if I get into a situation. So it really affects the decisions you make out in the field, and it bolsters your sense of self-reliance.
Yeah, you have to be very cautious, don't you?
You do. I think more so as we get older and have a family and other folks that we always want to return safely to, as you tend to take less risks, but still keep things fun. But it's different if you're on for instance, a rafting adventure with a partner, or a trailing raft. You might tackle some water, do some things that you wouldn't do if you're paddling alone with a pack raft.
Yeah, exactly.
Water that you might paddle out to if you have a group. You tend to make the decision to pull over and maybe portage that particular spot if you might not make it through the other end safely.
Yeah, and there's nobody to pick you up out of the water if you do crash. So give me an example of maybe a hunting trip what do you normally hunt for? I mean, what's your normal MO?
Sheep is probably my favorite hunt of any type in Alaska. I enjoy getting up into the high mountains and as the theme of the show is, it's solitude. You tend not to run into any other people and you really have to be self-sufficient out there to be an effective sheep hunter.
And athletic too. I mean, you really got to have some significant training and ability to really cover some vertical terrain and do it for a long time because it's really challenging.
To be effective, absolutely. And often it's hard to find, the right qualities in a sheep hunting partner. And so, I'm not the only guy that sheep hunts alone. I do have, one partner that I've been sheep hunting with for many, many years. And it's not by coincidence. And you don't just invite anybody to go up in the mountains with you because, that person has to be at basically your same or approximate level of fitness. So you're not waiting for them or they're not talking yet or climbing up the next mountain. And as well as being able to share a tent with somebody for sometimes 3 or 4 days in the rain and snow.
Yeah, yeah. So what do you do for communications when you're out there? I mean, I don't get the sense that you're a daredevil. You're not doing this because you want to make it more risky or anything. You're just doing it because it's rewarding and you want to go when you want to go. And so do you take like a sat phone or do you do any of those backup kind of things when you're out on your own?
I don't. I've never owned a sat phone. I probably should, but it's just one more piece of gear, one more, crutch that I don't want to have to depend on it. The batteries being charged, having my minutes, prepaid and those types of things. I tend to go with people, when I don't go solo, the person I'm with usually has a sat phone. It's pretty much standard in Alaska now, but I don't carry one. It's not because I, want to face a situation where I can't call for help if I need to, but, it might also affect my decision-making knowing that I can't call for help if I need to, or I'm somehow going to need to, crawl or drag myself, 30 or 40 miles back to the riverboat or the airplane or wherever my, launching point was. But I do own an airplane also, and so one of the things I do when I'm flying is I've recently purchased one of these GPS communicating devices where you can send you know, messages to folks, and it works off the satellite network. So I think they're, you know, all just as effective as a phone, but yeah, you're not tempted to, you know, call and have a conversation with people at home every night, which, you know, to me, kind of detracts from the wilderness experience. But you tend to fall into that rut if you're carrying an actual phone, but you still can communicate in case of an emergency.
You know, I totally understand what you're talking about, it, that when I was younger and would do trips and, you know, backpacking trips or whatever, boating, you get out there and you have this sense of aloneness that is very, I don't know, it's very special. It's hard to really explain to somebody who's not into it about why it would feel kind of unique and good to be out by yourself beyond communication. But it's something that I really do miss. And as Alaska's become more populated, it's been harder to come by. It's probably still easier to come by here than most places, but it's still, but you know, there's a lot more radio traffic. There's a lot more phones. Phones go a lot farther. And sort of that sense of being really self-reliant is harder to attain.
That's a real good observation, Charles. And I share that. And it's funny, I was watching just the other day, I think a 60 Minutes program on some meditation retreat. And one of the first things they did was, you know, take everybody's phone away from them and eliminate that source of distraction. And I think, you know, a lot of times when you go wilderness adventuring and you choose to do it solo, you know, that's part of what you're trying to achieve, is that some kind of meditative experience where you're living in the moment. You're not worried about what's going on with your emails and who's trying to get a hold of who. And you know, you can really just, again, live for the moment, which I think is one of the draws of challenging the Alaska wilderness.
Yeah, and you kind of get, I think you put your finger on something, you can kind of get into a different frame of mind. I've thought about this, that when I spent a lot of time in Prince William Sound, and actually communications used to be much less out there than they are now. Now it's really, you can almost make a cell phone call most places. And when I started, you know, you couldn't even reach anybody on VHF radio. And you get into this frame of mind where you're not watching the clock anymore. You're watching the tides. You're sort of watching the weather. You're alone with your thoughts and just a very different way of thinking, and kind of can sometimes seems like you can think longer thoughts rather than when you're in town and it's, you're jumping from one interruption to the next.
Exactly. Or sometimes think about nothing at all, which is, which is hard to do when you're plugged into the world.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about you?
Or you're entertaining, or you know, when you have partners in the field, you're always, you know, you're carrying on some conversation or interacting with people, and again, that sometimes you know, keeps you from, as you said, you know, not, you know, paying attention to where the sun is on the horizon rather than what time it is on your clock.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you don't want to be like the grim, incommunicative one when you're with your partner, right? You got to keep up the conversation so you don't seem like like you've gone around the bend or something. So I was going to, you've done quite a bit of long distance running and skiing, marathons, 100-kilometer races. We've got that 100-mile White Mountain race up there in Fairbanks. I'm curious as to where your mind goes when you're doing those. Is that like you're saying, like clear your mind, not think about anything? Or how do you, when you're alone racing for 24 hours, where does your mind go?
It goes all over the place, which is one of the neat things about it is you know, yeah, you go through all sorts of different mindsets and frames of mind as you're you know, working through a, for instance, a 100-mile race. And I'll talk about the White Mountains, because one year it took me I think about 23 hours of nonstop skiing in some pretty rough conditions, you know, below zero and blizzards and, you know, cross and overflow and, you know, things that really keep you challenged constantly. And so, you know, when your mind's engaged, you know, thinking about all these things, you know, for that long, it really challenges you. You know, I haven't faced, you know, some of the things I did ride mushers talk about when they're riding a sled for, you know, 24 hours straight where they hallucinate and other things. I've never experienced that, nor do I think I want to, but your mind goes in different places, and sometimes it's just fun to, you know, concentrate on, you know, the frost developing in front of you, or, you know, you tend to notice things that you don't notice when you're just out for an hour ski at Kincaid or at Birch Hill.
Yeah, and I think that part of the ability to finish one of those races is your psychological ability to deal with your own discomfort, your own fears, just the fact that are you able to just sort of focus in on the task at hand? Because talking to some extreme endurance athletes on the show, I sort of said, you know, it only takes one negative thought to drop out, right? And they were some of the most positive people I'd ever met.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, those kind of thoughts, you know, always creep in your mind. But I think if you're going to be a successful endurance racer, you can't let those creep in your mind. You have to set out and keep the mindset that you're going to finish that thing no matter what. And, you know, often that's, you know, the thought process is just gets down to, you know, start doubting yourself. You have to just start thinking, okay, I'm just going to get through the next mile or get through the next half mile, or even I'm going to make it up to that next tree, you know, and just set whatever goals your mind needs to set to, you know, achieve the ultimate goal, which, you know, is finishing the event or, you know, in some cases, you know, finishing the event first, mm-hmm. which means, you know, leaving behind everybody. And then you get in a competitive frame of mind too, not only, you know, thinking about the next source of calories you're going to take in, but also, you know, who might be catching you, which is a good motivator in any adventure race, particularly in the longer ones. You have to, you know, sometimes convince yourself that someone's gaining on you in order to continue to motivate you to move forward fast.
Just keep pushing. Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, it's funny, you get to the end and people will talk about the different challenges they encounter, but you alone know what kind of challenges you can encounter mentally. You know, that's not something you're ever going to share with anybody, really.
No, and I think every time, you know, you do something challenging, you can push those boundaries further. And, you know, I realize there's a lot more folks in Alaska that have much higher pain thresholds and boundaries, you know, than I've developed in the relatively minor stuff that I do. But, you know, there is satisfaction. For instance, I've won a couple of those White Mountain 100 races by at the last checkpoint when I'm skiing with somebody, and you know, they decide for whatever reason that they're going to linger at the warm cabin and maybe eat one more bowl of soup, and I get up and go and invite them to come, and you know, they politely decline. Then I know as I step out the door, I'm going to win the race because I was, you know, stronger at that point, or I was able to resist the temptation of sitting in a warm cabin and eating a bowl of soup.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever, I mean, that brings up the point, another reason to go it alone sometimes is if your goals or your desires for a trip are just more extreme than anybody that you know who wants to go. And I've talked to a couple of people about this who said, well, actually, in fact, Lonnie in our previous interview said, well, I'd love to have somebody go with me, but I don't know anybody who would be willing to do this.
And I've seen that as well in a lot of the things I do. You know, some people refuse to go, you know, bird hunting with me because they know that I'll, you know, put in, you know, many, many miles. Or, you know, if they go duck hunting with me, they're getting up at 5 a.m. and they're going to go, you know, walk through the marsh or build a blind or, you know, whatever else at uncomfortable hours and times. And you know, sheep hunting are going to be hiking up mountains rather than just sticking to the low valleys. And so it's, you know, it's self-selecting, but then it's enjoyable also because I get to do the stuff I want to do, how I want to do it, not, you know, waiting for somebody or staying home because, you know, I couldn't find a partner to go with.
Yeah. Well, and if you do take somebody along and you have different expectations of comfort, then it's kind of negative for both people. You know, one is being dragged along into doing stuff they don't want to do, and the other is being held back. And I'm sure you've probably experienced that.
Yes.
So that teaches a lesson for the next time. So what are some of your goals? I mean, you've won some of these long races. You are competitive outdoors, and it sounds like you do some pretty extreme stuff. How do you set your goals for what you want to do next?
Basically, at this stage of my life, I only like doing the things that I enjoy doing. And I enjoy the long-distance ski races because they're not painful. It's difficult for people to understand how a 100-mile race in 23 hours couldn't be painful, but it's you know, skiing's such so easy on your body. I don't have an interest in doing 100-mile running races, for instance, because, you know, I know that's going to hurt. You know, some of my goals, I've always wanted to climb McKinley. You know, not something that I've put in on my short-term radar, but, you know, something that I think growing up in Alaska, most people want to do. And, you know, I have the ability to do it, and it's just a matter of making that a goal and pursuing it. But, you know, that's sometime in the future. I want to continue doing these long ski races, and there's a lot of adventures I want to do with my airplane. I want to go land up in tall mountains and hunt ptarmigan and take my skate skis up in the spring and do some solo stuff with an airplane park somewhere and ski for 20 miles along a ridgetop, turn around and come back. Those are the kind of things I want to do this year.
Oh, man, that sounds amazing. So doing some crust skiing by airplane, that's one I hadn't heard before, but that sounds like some fun. And for people who don't know, crust skiing is when you skate on that hard late season crust, so you float on top of the snow and you can go really, really fast.
It's a fantastic way to ski, and we don't have much of it here in Fairbanks. I know in Anchorage you have crust skiing in April and May, and you have access to the mountains by road, and we don't have much of that here. And our snow goes pretty quick when it goes, but that's something I plan on doing a lot of this spring and really getting into remote places. And again, something I'm unlikely to find a compatible partner to do with. So if I'm going to do it, I got to do it alone.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, great, Mike. Good luck with your adventures. And it sounds like whatever you're doing, you're going to be having some fun and meeting some amazing challenges. I appreciate your being with us. Mike Kramer from Fairbanks. Oh, yeah. And say hi to my friends up there. Mike Kramer from Fairbanks. He's an attorney, but he's also quite an outdoorsman. But it's part of our show today, talking about people who like to go out and do it alone. It's Outdoor Explorer. The next segment comes from our repeating feature, recorded live in front of an audience. The Trail Tales Show is put on by Alaska Trails at the 49th State Brewery. We're going to hear from Vicki Ho, the writer of Cautionary Tales, an Anchorage Daily News column about lessons learned the hard way in the outdoors. In this story, you'll hear how she learned about being in the moment and enjoying time alone in Alaska.
So I'm used to doing a lot of things alone, but that wasn't always the case. Before I moved here from Colorado, I never would have hiked alone, never would have camped alone. But I moved here alone, and I had a boyfriend at the time, and he was supposed to join me that fall. This was when I moved here, it was back in January 2015. A few months later, I got dumped. I mean, I was so sad. I was a complete sad sack. I threw myself into work. I signed up to work 70 hours a week. No one does that. And I didn't really have much of a social life. And so I thought to myself, man, Alaska is a terrible place to be alone, right? And I came to a decision one day. I thought, I could either wallow in self-pity forever, or I could try to enjoy some of what Anchorage has to offer. I chose the second path, and I started hiking. And I have to apologize to the Chugach in general. I would start off hiking at this really angry pace. I was still so upset and so sad. I'd be like stomping around, I'd be sweating, I'd be muttering obscenities under my breath. I was the crazy person on the trail that you did not want to run into. And so I'm sorry if you saw me in those early days. But as I would follow the trail, I would approach a summit, get to a lake, be looking up at the canopy of the trees, and I would think, God, this is overwhelming and this is beautiful. And I mean, I loved being out there, but as I was hiking, I was like, man, what was I so upset about in the first place? Completely forgot. So for me, solo hiking is a little bit like free therapy. But there is one trip last spring that really tested how much I love solitude. So last April, I went out to the Rabbit Lake Trailhead after work. I work nights. So I got to the trailhead around 11 p.m. And night hiking is kind of standard operating procedure with me because I've lost my mind. And I strapped on my pack and I headed out in the snow. And after a couple miles, I got tired and lazy, and the wind started picking up. And for anyone who's been back in that valley when it's windy, you know that the farther back you get, the worse that wind is. And I knew that at the time, so I thought, you know, I'll stop, I'll head out to the side of the trail, I'll set up camp, I'll go to sleep, it'll be fine. I climbed into my tent, and while the wind outside wasn't necessarily so bad, once I got into my tent, it was a different story. So if you've seen the movies where there's an engineer or a group of engineers testing out some kind of equipment for a plane or a spacecraft, and they flip a switch, and it activates a wind tunnel, and you hear that whooshing sound all around you in this giant cavernous space, that's what it felt like to be in the tent at that moment. And it felt like a giant was just shaking that tent for a really long time, just some bored giant. I was like, ah. And so I thought, God, I don't know how I'm ever gonna sleep in this tent, but I'm out here, I'm committed. I would see the lights of Anchorage through the tiny little plastic vinyl window of my tent. And that was comforting to me. That was reassuring. I mean, my car is only a few miles away. And eventually I drifted off to sleep. But then about half an hour later, I woke up to the feeling of my tent sliding downhill in the snow. And I don't know if you've ever experienced that sensation before. I just hope to God you never do, because you can't see anything. You can't see anything outside of your tent. All you feel is just, you're going downhill, this tent is taking you down with it. And I stopped briefly, there are some bushes there, thought, oh, like, what can I do? And then the wind picked up again and sent me down farther. Finally, I came to a stop against some branches, and I dug in an elbow in one corner of my tent, and the heel of my foot in the opposite corner of the tent. My back was braced against the wall. The wind was threatening to send me like end over end down the hillside, and that was the one thing I did not want to happen. So I was like, God, what? Like, a reasonable person at that point says, hey, I'll pack up, I'll go home. But when you're out in the backcountry a lot on your own, you develop a sort of stubborn streak. And sometimes that really helps you. That helps get you through some difficult situations, some weird terrain. You know, sometimes stubbornness really helps you. In this case, it worked against me. And so I spent, I was like this, elbow in one corner, heel in the opposite, back against the wall. I stayed like that in the world's worst game of Twister for about 2 hours. And I would drift off to sleep, and then the wind would pick up again, and I'd jolt awake, and all of my muscles would tense up all over again. So finally, I gave up. Said, hey, this is a horrible idea. And when I was packing up, I saw that my tent had slid all of 15 feet. But in my mind, you know, it could have been 1,500 feet. I had no idea what was going on. So I started hiking back to my car. And by that time, first light started to arrive. The sky was gray overhead, and slowly the clouds went away. And it was the most beautiful sunrise I'd ever seen. Like, God, it'd be such a shame to waste this morning. But I hiked back, got to my car, started driving out, and there's one intersection where if I go straight, that's the road that takes me home. But I found myself like a woman possessed. I turned the steering wheel right, and I ended up at the trailhead to Wolverine Peak. So I hiked up to Wolverine Peak, and there's this feeling that I get on almost every hike where I look around and I think, you know, man, I feel so bad for anyone who isn't right here at this moment, at this time, right now. You know, I just at this place, there's nowhere else I would rather be. I felt that way when I was at Wolverine, even after this hellish night off the Rabbit Lake Trail. And in that moment, I also thought to myself, man, Alaska's a great place to be alone. So thank you.
That was Vicky Ho speaking about learning to go it alone at Trail Tales, hosted by our friends at Alaska Trails. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. Today, we're talking about spending time in the outdoors alone. I'm going to turn it over to our producer, Monica Gokey, for our last segment. She caught up with Michael Quine, a 28-year-old security guard from Washington, D.C., who put his life on hold to try and visit every national park in the U.S. Quine called his trip the American Walkabout. Monica Gokey has more.
I was trying to think of some witty comment to start this out with, something about people who like to be alone and finding them over the internet, but my wits failed me on this one. But we did find Michael Quine through the internet. He posted sort of an unusual rant to our radio show's Facebook page. It involved a lot of talk about beauty and harshness and a solo trip for the record books. At the time, Quine was newly returned from a year-long tour of American national parks. In his own words, he was, quote, disengaged from societal pursuits to set out alone and face the uncertainty guaranteed by the wilderness, end quote. He calls the project the American Walkabout. And after clicking through Quine's blog, theamericanwalkabout.blogspot.com, I knew I wanted to talk to him. It turns out, Michael Quine is not really the serious loner type I first pegged him as. He's a pretty ordinary guy who, in his late 20s, wanted to shake his life up a bit with some outdoor adventure. He joins us now from Washington, D.C. Hey, Michael, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So let's start out with your trip. Tell me about how you came up with the idea to do a self-guided tour of our national parks.
Well, actually, about 2 years ago, I came up with this plan to kind of go and leave my corporate job, at least temporarily, and set out and find an adventure that I'd only, you know, read about in books and like the Odyssey and the Iliad, and was kind of dissatisfied with not really having that kind of adventure in my life. So I figured I'd just stop everything and go find it. So what I did was, for a year I planned, you know, kind of loosely planned a trip through each of the national parks, all the parks in the lower 48 states, and then as much as I could afford to get to in the Alaska national parks, just because there were so many more parks in Alaska that I wanted to get to. It's just the logistics of getting to them are a little bit more challenging than they are down here.
I feel embarrassed for not knowing this off the top of my head, but how many parks are there in the U.S.?
So there are 59 national parks across the United States, to include the lower 48, Alaska, Hawaii, and then some of the territories like American Samoa and the American U.S. Virgin Islands. So 59 total. Let's see, there are 8 in Alaska, of which I went to 3.
What were some of the highlights of your trip? Any favorite parks stand out?
I mean, Alaska was up there. Denali particularly was just so wild. I mean, Denali can be very tame in a way because it's structured so that everyone can really experience the park through like the buses and the lodges. But I tended to try to take things a little bit more rugged, go backpacking wherever I went, which for me was more rewarding. But other places down in the lower 48, I went to Olympic National Park in Washington, which is incredible. It has rainforest, a coast, and then it has an alpine region. And just, I mean, some of the stuff that I got myself into there was just unbelievable. Also, Canyonlands in Utah. Utah has, I think, 5 national parks, all of which are just mind-blowing and so unlike anywhere else. Like, the terrain there is just so unique.
Tell me about the Alaska part of your trip.
It was absolutely incredible. It was, you know, I'm from the East Coast, so Alaska just seems so far away. And in a way, it is, distance-wise. But it was, I mean, the landscape up there is just nothing compared to anything that I'd ever seen before. So I spent almost a little over a month and a half there. At the end of last summer, from August to September. Getting up there, I took the ferry through the Alaska Marine Highway and met people, found ways to hitchhike to various parts of the state, went to Denali National Park first, and had one of the most rewarding experiences of my life there. Just extreme solitude, surrounded by just like the most enormous landscapes that you can even imagine. I remember climbing Igloo Mountain in Denali National Park, and it just being probably one of the most redefining moments of my life.
What was it about Igloo Mountain that really got to you?
You know, it's probably not really one of the more well-known parts of Denali Park. In fact, it's probably no different than many parts of the actual national park itself. I just happened to, when I made my my route for the hanging out in the for exploring the backcountry, Igloo Mountain just happened to be kind of a happy accident. It looked like terrain that I was able to navigate, solo. Being a solo backpacker in the grizzly infested backwoods or backcountry of the Denali National Park. So it was a happy accident. It was just, it's not a huge mountain, but it was the first time that year where I felt like I was truly in a landscape that was unforgiving. You know, that's what I'd been looking for this whole time, and then I felt like I had finally reached that when I got to Igloo Mountain.
What did it look like out there?
You know, the terrain was almost like this tundra, like spongy grass. After I got past the tree line and I got to the top, and I could see these, 360 view of these snow-capped mountains. And again, being from the Washington, D.C. area, you know, those don't exist. So this was really an eye-opening moment for me. And just like the solitude.
Michael, why did you decide to go this one alone?
Well, actually, when I first planned this journey, it wasn't something I was actually planning on doing with myself or by myself. Originally, the plan was to take my then girlfriend along with me. We were going to do this adventure together. But without getting into like the sob story or anything like that, that relationship ended. So, but instead of just kind of ignoring the plans, I kind of stuck with it and went on my own. And I'm not saying the adventure would have been bad had I done it with someone else. It just would have been a completely, completely different story, I think, in the end.
Any close calls when you were out there by yourself in some of America's most remote parks?
So I can't swim. I can't swim well. I can barely doggy paddle. But I was doing water adventures all the time, and I, you know, had a life preserver on, and I just kind of like hoped that my inflatable kayak wouldn't pop. Or when I was down in the Everglades, I did a 100-mile solo canoe trip from the top of the Everglades down to the bottom, and it was 100 miles. It took about 9 to 10 days to complete, and it was something that I had kind of told myself I was going to do the day before. So there was no time to prepare, or very little time to prepare, and I kind of just jumped in head first without really thinking like, well, maybe this is a good idea, maybe this is a bad idea. Halfway through it, it's almost like it became autopilot, this sense of determination to just kind of push myself. And luckily, I didn't get eaten by an alligator or drown or anything like that, so that was good.
Did you ever have any moments on the trip where you started to think, maybe this wasn't such a great idea after all?
All the time. Just in terms of, like, danger, yeah, all the time. But in terms of, like, is it worth it? No, I always thought that, I don't know. There were some times where I'm like, what am I doing? Especially when I first started, I was like, I remember the first week I was in Isle Royal National Park, which is an island within Lake Superior. And I just remember it being my first week. It had been the first time I'd gone backpacking in years, or like long distance backpacking. I just remember thinking to myself, oh man, this is going to be a really long year.
What do you think your friends and family were thinking when you told them about this trip?
I consider myself a pretty social person. So when I would tell my friends that I was going to go spend a year outside by myself, a lot of them were kind of confused. I don't think they were really worried because I grew up camping and backpacking, so this isn't something that physically was going to be something that people were concerned about, more just like my mental well-being, I think, more than anything.
Michael, would you say you're a different person after doing this trip?
Oh, most definitely.
How so?
I think it would be hard to define how. I think, like, coming back, I think people are like, oh, Mike, good, you're not, like, a loner. You're not going to, like, go not talk to anyone because you're so used to this isolation. So I'm still, like, the same person. I still get the same sense of humor and stuff like that. So my personality has stayed fairly much the same. I think just what my values are have changed a lot. I think things that I used to put a lot of value and importance on tended to be a little bit more on the materialistic side before. Where now, you know, I realize what I really don't need, and that I can actually survive on very little. So I think it's kind of given me this perspective where, you know, a minimalist lifestyle is actually a little bit more rewarding because the less you have to kind of distract yourself, the more time you have to kind of go explore and meet new people and kind of go on new adventures and actually collect experiences rather than just things. Sure, I got lonely at times, but, you know, I really did want to do this without any kind of comforts that I was used to, you know? So living in my tent for a year really stripped me of those physical comforts. And then I was also stripped from the mental comforts of just, you know, having someone to talk to. So not having that instant connection whenever I wanted really forced me to kind of like, you know, dive into my, this is going to sound kind of cheesy, but like dive into my soul or to my mind to really kind of get to know myself better for better or for worse. And I think for better for the most part.
You just heard from Michael Quine. He snapped a lot of pictures from his trip to all the national parks, and you can find a link to those photos plus his blog on our website at alaskapublic.org. That's all for today's show. I want to say thanks to our today's guest, solo adventurers Lonnie Dupree, Michael Kramer, and Michael Quine. You heard music today from Alaska artist Kevin Worrell and Michael Howard. Find links to their music on our website at alaskapublic.org. And thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. We had help today from Grace Bogine and from Evan Erickson. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
This episode of Outdoor Explorer first aired in January of 2015. It has been edited to be replayed here today.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.